Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. For this first episode of 2026, we wanted to offer you something slightly different, a reflection on some of the positives that marked 2025 and a touch of hope for the year ahead. So we've asked three voices from the maritime world, representing academia, the bunkering industry, and environmental NGOs, to each choose one positive development in 2025 and one wish for 2026. We'll start with Tristan Smith, Professor of Energy and Transport at the UCL Energy Institute. So Tristan, as your positive highlight for the past year, you've decided to talk about progress for ammonia as a marine fuel. So what has changed in practical terms during the last 12 months?
Sometimes it's very incremental, so it's quite hard to detect. But when I thought back in response to you asking me that question, I suddenly realised that 25 saw a number of milestones being passed across the value chain for ammonia. And just to explain another reason why I picked ammonia, we've obviously for a long time as a research group pointed to it as being one of the promising long-run solutions that the sector will use in its energy transition and become increasingly important. And so seeing it evolve is something that we identified was a necessary step. We need to get some more tangible alternative fuels that can reach zero emissions cost effectively. And that needs to happen at this stage in the 20s, even though we might not be using them at volume until the mid or even the late 30s. We just need to see them starting to progress through these milestones. And so we've always said this was a precondition to happen. So it's really gratifying that a number of things did happen this year. And I'll just pick a couple of them. So one of them was the successful green ammonia auctions that happened in India. These weren't particularly for maritime offtake, but they showed how national governments were starting to stimulate this particular fuel production and the supply chain. And the outcome of those auctions were prices. So they revealed some price points, which were broadly in line with expectations, I think, but encouraging for those who were trying to consider whether it could be a competitive fuel, because they'd put it not far away from some of the biofuels that are available for shipping's use. So good upstream progress, but also good progress on the technology that we might use on ships. Avalanche, amongst others, announced having engines that were now ready for the market. We knew that they were in development. They'd been in testing phases over the past multiple years. So to hear them reach fruition in 25, more or less on track as they had originally stated, was very reassuring. IMO adopted interim ammonia safety guidelines, so not just the technology, the fuel production, but now also the safety culture that needs to be in place for us to be able to do this safely. And then very recently, we saw the announcement by MSC of a new AIP so an approval in principle on a 21,000 TEU container ship. And this is not the same as someone launching a vessel. So an AIP doesn't mean that they've designed it or built it, but it's a sort of critical enabler of us having one of the big liners announcing something firmer in 26, 27, which then really starts to shift the dynamics, because we then have ammonia as a serious player alongside the methanol ships and the LNG ships that have already been ordered. And I think until we have it being ordered for that portion of the fleet, we already have other orders, but seeing it in the big container ships will be another critical milestone that hopefully is now much closer.
Now, you've talked about different pieces of the puzzle kind of getting into place to make ammonia as a marine fuel a reality. What is still missing? What still needs to happen? And how do you see that making a difference for the bigger picture of shipping's energy transition?
Well, the main thing that's missing is the business case, right? And the business case is missing because we don't have either local regulation or a global regulation. Either of those could help us. To expand on that a bit, I mean, we had the Green Corridors launched by the UK government at COP26, and then various other governments sort of making announcements off that. So Norway, amongst others, who said, yeah, we need to progress this. Small amounts have been done in national governments. So there's a bit of public funding that's going in. A lot of it is CapEx. So that makes it very difficult for ship owners to sign offtake agreements, because they might have the grant that builds the ship or the production facility, but they don't have the long-run business case. There's still a significant cost gap for a maritime offtaker, which isn't going to be closed until we have a stable regulatory regime. The IMO net zero framework could have provided that. We'll talk about that perhaps more in a second. But in the gap of time that we have before that enters, and that wouldn't flow revenues certainly until 29, now probably 30, 31, that wouldn't flow a business case until later this decade. We still have multiple years where these impressive and significant other milestones need us some support, and in our work significantly that needs to come from national governments or regional governments. EU regulation has generated lots of revenues. Those could be spent making sure that this really kicks off effectively over this period of time, as could other national initiatives.
And now turning to your wish for 2026, you've chosen to talk about the IMO Net Zero Framework, or more specifically about your hope that it will be adopted as is when the extraordinary NEPC session reconvenes after that 1 year delay. Why would that be preferable to reopening the deal to try and find a compromise, in your opinion?
So it already is a compromise, right? The net zero framework that was approved in principle was a compromise between some countries that wanted something more ambitious and some that wanted something less ambitious. We reached an agreement. We had a meeting in October that was fundamentally sabotaged by the United States administration, and colluded with the Saudis to create a dynamic at the IMO that was, deeply unhelpful for a sector that needed stability, deeply unhelpful for global trade, deeply, deeply unhelpful for efforts to control climate change. So we had that meeting went as badly as it could have done. Almost, it could have, perhaps there are scenarios that were even more brutal, but, and at least we now have the reconsideration in 12 months' time. And obviously, one of the scenarios that we have is that we open up that framework and we make modifications. But in my logic, there is no modification that will make this acceptable to the United States. They've clearly stated, this is ideologically, this is not something, you can't have a negotiation with someone who is ideologically opposed to global climate regulation. So it would be foolish for those making that suggestion, I think, to reopen this. And I think that if we do reopen it, we're going to hear a lot of people say, yes, but we said we needed this other, more ambitious solution that we've already compromised on. So if you're going to reopen it, we're going to reiterate that demand, where actually in April, we had got an agreement across 90% of the Marple-Annex 6 signatories that were taking a position in that discussion, that we had a compromise that was satisfying all of those, including those at extremes of the position. So I think that's why it feels to me like the most obvious practical way to make progress is now to adopt the net zero framework as is at this forthcoming meeting. But I do expect to spend the next 12 months talking about the compromise proposals that people will be throwing around, and very unhelpfully, in my opinion.
Now, you've alluded to it, but there are loads of geopolitical forces at play in this debate. So what needs to happen in the next year for your wish to become a reality and for the IMO Net Zero Framework to be adopted in October?
So I think there was a constituency of member states who voted for deferment that were pressured by the United States, in particular, but also, other threats. And that constituency need to be better equipped to consider whether or not that pressure should flip their position. So there's information that they need to have available at their highest levels, because a lot of the United States interference was straight to heads of state, which it's very hard to normally engage on this topic. I think now they've been pulled into it, they might be more interested to see some of the technical detail that they might need to understand to calculate that trade-off. So there's a lot of information, evidence that could be developed. There's also a constituency that genuinely, I think, wanted more time and saw an opportunity to double check that they had this in their national interest and that it was the right way forwards. So similarly, there's more work that we could do in thinking through, A, what's this net zero framework as is really looking like? And that will be improved as we get some of the detail out in the guideline discussions. And one of the things that is good news from October is that ISWG20 had a productive week of discussion that has now spun into various ongoing efforts to add detail into guidelines, which I think will be able to come back into the discussion before we have the adoption decision on the net zero framework. And that will allow countries to say, well, actually, now I can see a bit more detail. Is it my worst case scenario, or my best case scenario, or somewhere in between, and make a decision informed by that information, as well as more of their own internal debates and considerations as to whether or not they genuinely want this. So I think there's a lot that can be done in this period, which is why I don't think it's impossible at all that we could end up adopting net zero framework as is, but just 12 months later, amongst the other reasons being that that is obviously by far the preferable solution for the climate.
Thank you so much, Tristan.
Thank you very much.
I'm now turning to Alexander Prokopakis, Executive Director of the International Bunker Industry Association, IDIA. So Alex, as your positive highlight for 2025, you've chosen to talk about industry collaboration that emerged after the extraordinary MEPC session in October. What did that collaboration look like in practice?
You mentioned it, and it was extraordinary session by definition, by its name, and what happened. And I think it came out from what we saw, not only associations like us coming together through a common goal in discussing something. And this is giving me, if I'm allowed, a small parenthesis on that subject about IMO. A lot of people see it as a failure of not reaching a decision. That's not the case. We believe it's a failure from the governments being able to find a solution what the industry has been asking for. It's the first time that industry is asking for regulations, and I think the governments failed on that. With that said, we saw around this discussion before the session a lot of collaboration between associations, for example, us and ICS, interesting bodies, stakeholders, ports, something that continued after the extraordinary session. I don't want to comment on the politics because that's what it was at the end. It was all politics, and we saw how some governments strong-arm some others. So we leave this aside. Aside of that, the stakeholders continue to collaborate because we would need in the next year or so to find a better solution, a better worded solution in order to move forward. Because in our view, some people say that the net zero framework is done. We don't believe that. This is an opportunity for the industry to come together, prove that we can collaborate and work better together. So that's where my thinking came around the IMO MEPC extraordinary session. And I think that the industry saw its resilience, saw the belief in the system that we all need to have common rules, global rules. And this is, as IBI, our biggest fear, that we don't want to see local or regionalized rules that will alter the level playing field of shipping, the competitive advantage and the strength of shipping. So if we are able to have a global harmonized rule, I think it's in the benefit of the global trade.
And now you talk about collaboration between different organizations and companies. Could you give a few examples of projects that have emerged during the year?
There are many. I mean, we saw GCMD working out with other either companies, private initiatives or governments to produce results. I mentioned before our common announcement with ICS. A lot of people believe wrongly, obviously, that shipping and bankering cannot go in hand in hand, but this is a mistake. We've proven that, you know, when there's a common interest for the good of our we come together. We have seen competitors. I cannot give specific examples because I don't know if they want to be publicized that much. But coming together in order to produce some tools for the net zero framework. And then last but not least, you know, under the Global Maritime Forum, we see people coming together through that in order to have, again, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but a common goal of what we want for an industry. I think that was the driver behind all stakeholders.
And now, what difference do you think this has made or will make for shipping's decarbonization, especially in the absence of that global framework that we were expecting from the IMO?
I think we'll make that collaboration stronger. I mean, we need to sit back in the table and see where we failed to convince the government that a global regime will be helpful for the industry. Obviously, one thing is it was the monetary issue, because when you're talking about the tunes of 10 to 15 billion, obviously everybody wants to know where the funds will go. So that is one aspect. But overall, you know, taking a step back, seeing where the proposal wasn't complete and what it needs to be worked at, I think it's what the industry needs to come together. And from all the discussion we have at the as association with our members and stakeholders is that, okay, we can sit down, refine it. Now there is a concern because we all know that it's postponed for a year. Is it a year really enough to make all these adjustments? I'm hoping it is. The reality is that it might not, because there's a lot of aspects that we need to revisit. But hopefully, now that we are in the new years, I think it will be a good opportunity to put our working gloves up and start rolling our sleeves and work on it in order to produce some different things, because we need to present something different. Because if the same proposal goes ahead, then obviously when you're doing the same thing, you see different results.
And now for this new year that is starting, you said that your hope is for the industry to invest in people. What does that look like in tangible terms? In other words, what should individual companies put on their to-do list to make it a reality?
I would say three things. Training, and training. It's something that my feeling is that we have put a little bit aside. I mean, one of the things that all of us in shipping see, the safety first, big red letters and non-smoking that we have in front of the vessels. And we need to revisit these things because as the regime, the fuels, the procedures change, we need to train our people. They are the ones who actually move these vessels. So they need to have the proper training in order not to have accidents like we have in the past. Shipping has done great job in safety. The safety records for years have been better and better. We start seeing now some lapse on that with some containers fires, some container boxes missing over, some fires in other type. So all this safety concern needs to be translated into training. So my advice will be to go back to the basics, train our people, train them regularly, be sure we give them the tools in order to do the job. Because when they have the tools, then it has proven through history that they're doing the job and they're doing it excellent. So that's what I said, three things to focus: training.
And do you think that those questions around people and training have been overlooked so far in all those discussions about the decarbonization and digital transformations? And do you feel among your members that this is starting to change now?
Between our members, probably not, because one of the pillars of IBIA for the last at least 3 years that I'm in the helm as the executive director, training is one of the three pillars. Yes, I have the feeling as an industry in whole, it has been a little bit in the back burner because we had very good records, not so many accidents, and maybe things could start slipping. That's why I'm ringing the bell now and saying training, so we don't get into a point that, you know, something left behind. So far, training for us, at least, like I said, in IBIA has been in the front. It will continue to be. And we urge other stakeholders and associations to do the same.
Thank you very much, Alex.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me to start the year like this and having this broadcast with your audience. It's a pleasure.
And to finish, I'm pleased to welcome Sean Pryor, Shipping Director at Seas at Risk and Lead Advisor for the Clean Arctic Alliance. So Sean, as your positive development in 2025, you've selected a decision at the IMO that was actually largely overshadowed by the negotiations around the net zero framework, that is the approval of the North Atlantic Emission Control Area by NEPC 83 in April. So why was this such an important milestone in your opinion?
We think it's a really important milestone because of the geographic scope of the regulation. It's only been approved and it got overshadowed by the net zero framework discussions in the autumn, but we're hopeful it'll be adopted early in 2026. And it will help reduce air pollution from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way up the west coast of Europe and includes the waters of the Arctic waters of Iceland and Greenland. Although the regulation is aimed at reducing SOx and NOx pollution, it will also have an impact in terms of black carbon emissions from ships. And this is really important in the context of the Arctic, where black carbon is speeding up the melting of snow and ice. So this, I think, is a really positive development.
And now we know that that new emissions control area would bridge existing ECAs in the Canadian Arctic, Norwegian Sea, North Sea, and the Mediterranean. What is the extent of the changes this could trigger for the industry, and how much of a difference could this make for the environment?
It certainly joins together the emission control areas that have already been approved and adopted, and most of which are actually in place. Some come into place next year, but most have been in place now for a number of years. And what we're seeing as a consequence is that ships operating in these areas are cleaning up, are moving to cleaner fuels. So they're moving to distillate fuels in most cases. There are other ways of meeting the requirements of emission control areas. But the cleaner fuels result in less air pollution and therefore have important consequences for the environment.
We saw that the proposal was initially approved without any opposition in April, but the formal adoption got delayed because the extraordinary MEPC session in October got adjourned for a year. Now, given the current geopolitics, are you confident that that ECA will be adopted this coming year?
Yes, I think we're hopeful. Obviously, we can't know what will play out in terms of the geopolitics. But this is a measure that has been on the IMO, or this type of regulation has been on the IMO's books and is available for countries to use for some time now. And this really is adding to the network of emission control areas. So it's not a new regulation, really. It's just extending the impact of a regulation that's been in place for some time. It's important from an air pollution and from a human health perspective, as well as from a climate perspective as well. So I think there's also benefits. It's not just about climate, which is what the geopolitics of today seem to be focused on.
And now turning to your wish for 2026, you've decided to talk about the approval of a new MARPOL regulation on polar fuels to limit black carbon emissions in the Arctic. Why is black carbon such a priority for you amid all of the other climate discussions that are underway at the moment?
Black carbon's a really important global priority because it has a disproportionate impact when it's released in and close to cryosphere areas being snow and ice. And obviously the Arctic is one of the biggest cryosphere areas on the planet. It speeds up, it's a climate pollutant anyway, and it's increasing heating while it's in the atmosphere. But the disproportionate impact comes when it settles out onto snow and ice and speeds up the melting. This is not only important for ecosystems and inhabitants of the Arctic, but it has consequences for the planet as a whole. The loss of Arctic sea ice and Arctic land ice is having impacts elsewhere in the world. And particularly climate-vulnerable countries are at risk from rising sea levels coming from the melting of glaciers, which is happening in the Arctic and in other parts of the world too. So this, although this is a measure, or we want to see a measure that is Arctic-specific, the impact of black carbon being emitted and losing the snow and ice in the Arctic is having a global impact.
Now, we know that discussions around polar fuels have been ongoing for more than 10 years now, and the next opportunity to reach an agreement would be at the meeting of the PPR subcommittee in February. Now, proposals ahead of that meeting were submitted in December. Is anything on the table satisfactory in your opinion?
Yes, there's a good proposal that's come from a number of countries on the table for PPR in February. This discussion of the proposal there will just be the first step. PPR is a technical subcommittee, so it needs to consider whether the proposal is suitable. We think it is. We think it's a good proposal and that it should be put forward. PPR, though, can't make the final decision. So PPR can make a recommendation, which would then be sent back to the parent committee, which is the Marine Environment Protection Committee. And if there is good support, then hopefully the proposal will be approved and then subsequently adopted. But this is really important, not, as I say, not just for the Arctic, but it is very important for Arctic and Arctic people, but it's important for the planet as a whole.
What is in that current proposal on the table that you're quite enthusiastic about?
The proposal will see a requirement that ships operating in the Arctic will need to move to cleaner fuels. So fuels that exist today. So we're not asking, you know, it's not a huge ask. These are fuels that are readily available, distillate fuels initially, but also some of the new low-carbon fuels that are coming onto the market now as well will be suitable. Some of them still emit black carbon, but they will have lower emissions of black carbon than the heavy residual fuels that we're still seeing widely used in the Arctic.
To finish, are you confident that 2026 could be the year when an agreement is reached and there is progress on that question of polyfuels?
We are really hopeful that 2026 will be the year when we see some progress and some movement on polar fuels. As you said, they've been under discussion now for over a decade. However, we've also talked about the geopolitics around today, and this does add a level of uncertainty. But we're hopeful at this stage that we can make progress in 2026.
Thank you very much, Sian.
Thank you.